Hey everyone, it's been a while, but we're back. It's the oneliner.com podcast, episode 90. I am Craig. As always, I am joined by Scott.
Delighted to meet you.
And Drew.
How do you?
We've got some apologising to do to you guys. We've got some making up to do. And it means we've also got a backlog of 9 titles to discuss with you. So batten down the hatches, because this could get a bit windy or something like that. Let's crack on. Such is the amount of time we have been out of circulation that we haven't even had a chance to speak about The Hunger Games. So we are nothing if not on the pulse. Scott, what's the deal with The Hunger Games, man?
Well, it's set in a dystopian future. Is there any other kind of future, I ask you? It's a cross between The Running Man and Twilight, I guess. But that's a bit unfair, because it's nothing like as bad as Twilight. Set in a post-Civil War America, I assume there is some sort of ill-defined shenanigans going on, which has resulted in certain states becoming oppressed by wealthier states. I presume this is supposed to have some kind of relevance to modern culture, but I don't quite see that myself. It is centred around the concept of the Hunger Games, where to make amends for their terrible behaviour during the war, these states who have rebelled are forced to send 2 children to fight to the death in a game of death, I suppose, is the best way to put it. Kind of like The X Factor, but with bows and arrows. This film follows Katniss Everdeen. Yeah, she's from Aberdeen, played by Jennifer Lawrence. She volunteers herself to save her younger sister from being entered into the games, and it follows her as she attempts to survive this gladiatorial nightmare. Much like most of the kind of earlier Harry Potter films, I've kind of isolated myself from it, so I've no idea if it's a good representation of the phenomenally popular, apparently, kids' book. I don't know how well it translates. By most accounts, everyone seems quite happy with it. It was certainly rather popular. It's a pretty decent film. There's not too much wrong with it. There's some fetching character design, or costume design, at least. There's some
rather.
There's some just crazy outfits in there. I mean, if this doesn't win the Oscar for sort of best whacked out outfits, then there's something seriously wrong with everyone.
Yeah, it's got to be some of the most notable or memorable costumes since probably The Fifth Element.
Mm-hmm. I mean, stupid and completely impractical and unbelievable and sort of puts you out of the moment of the film and all that kind of stuff, but they're really quite cool looking.
Oh no, the dress that went on fire, that seemed very sensible.
I can't really find out much of a plot in there. It's all about character development of Katniss and her eventual love affair as they try and game the game to get the most votes to get little help parcels and things like that. It's, as a character study, it's mildly interesting. As a concept, it is quite interesting. It obviously makes no sense whatsoever when you try and think about it and analyse it. They describe one of the states as being the mining state.
Yeah, that's
all it does in that state. Everyone just mines.
Yeah, well, that one I might let slide, right? I mean, there might be, it's perhaps what used to be Pennsylvania. There's a lot of coal mines. That's an industry there. That makes sense to a very limited degree. But one of the districts is the power workers district. An entire district of a nation that's just power stations. And everybody involved in the entire economy of the district works in a power station. That one was, I was finding hard to give any credence to at all.
I don't think the world bears a lot of scrutiny in it. Oh. It's enjoyable enough as you're sitting watching it. None of that really annoyed me too greatly when I was actually watching it. It's only when you try and think about it in isolation that it becomes amazingly stupid. The film itself has got a reasonable through line and it drags you along quite well. It's, if anything, kind of overplaying its hand a bit. It does go a bit too overboard with a lot of these concepts and it gilds too many lilies. There, at one point, they're being
wasps.
the wasps. It's like, they're bees. Bees and wasps are dangerous enough. You don't have to go and spend 5 minutes going, oh, they're genetically engineered wasps. They're called hunter killers or tracker
something jackets, were they not?
Tracker jackers. Yeah, it's like, oh, they're really bad wasps. They'll kill you quickly. Which is one of the
stupidest names for anything I've ever heard, ever.
So there's a few moments like that. It could derail you from just enjoying the film, but they're thankfully relatively rare, and for the most part, it's quite well handled. I enjoyed it well enough. Is it obviously as strong a franchise as Harry Potter? Then, well, no, but neither were the first 2 Harry Potter films, so let's see how it goes going forward.
It's certainly a stronger first film than the first Harry Potter was.
Yeah.
It wasn't 2.5 hours. Yeah. Of absolutely nothing happening with terrible acting.
Well, I say, oh goodness, yeah, as though I actually saw the first Harry Potter film. But I can certainly imagine it being. In terms of adaptations, it's kind of... I've read most of the first book, and it's a pretty decent adaptation. My problem with it is that it's far too familiar.
It seems quite derivative from the film, anyway.
That's true.
Yeah, I know it's a point that's been raised many times by other people, but really it's hard to get over the fact that it's essentially, you know... It's essentially a 12-rated version of Battle Royale, which is in itself essentially a more adult version of Lord of the Flies.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose we haven't seen too many of that kind of a film, but I don't know, I quite enjoyed it. It was a good adaptation. My problem with it was that I think the setup to the games themselves were probably the most effective part of the film. The first half of the film, before the guys actually go into the arena and start their argy-bargy, is... understated slightly, is a pretty effective piece of filmmaking, certainly as far as big sort of summer tent poles go, and especially material aimed at a younger audience. Younger audiences tend to be paid quite short thrift by studios with big budget fare, but this, I had the feeling that the studio kind of had the courage of their conviction with this, and it couldn't have been an easy sell. It's kind of... obviously, the books have been popular, but, I mean, they're nowhere near as popular as, you know, Twilight or Harry Potter. And also, the nature of the material makes it quite difficult. I think it's safe to say that you can get away with a lot more in a novel than you can in a film when you're aiming it at a younger audience. It's one thing to have sort of quite adult themes and things like violence on a written page, but it's quite another to have them displayed on a cinema screen in, you know, 7.1 surround. I was quite impressed with the conviction that the studio have shown, actually, in not shying away from some of the trickier elements. But for me, the film, actually, the weakest aspect of the film is the games themselves. And it felt, I wouldn't say it felt exploitative, but I didn't enjoy it so much when the guys actually got into the arena. And then when the fighting kicked off, it all kind of went a bit downhill. I think in terms of filmmaking and adaptation of the source material, then the first half of that film really effectively conveys this sense of dread. And even though everything's sort of discussed, you'll have to fill in the blanks yourself. Everything's sort of discussed in hushed tones, and a lot of stuff you have to read between the lines. But there's this really palpable sense of fear when the selection process is going on, and when the contestants or when the tributes, sorry, are preparing for the games themselves. That's all really effectively dealt with. And for me, actually, when it gets down to the nitty-gritty of these kids running about killing each other, it's actually fairly weak. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I enjoyed the first half of the film much more than I did the second. But overall, yeah, as far as these things go, and especially stuff marketed at kids, and especially with something which obviously has a view to being a franchise, I was actually quite impressed with how much had been invested.
Yeah, I'm down with that. The first half's definitely better than the second, or perhaps first two-thirds, really.
Mm.
Just look at running time here. It's 142 minutes, and it doesn't feel it.
No, not at all.
The sort of second half of the film does suffer from it having more of the stupid things, and where it's just basically using sort of sufficiently advanced technology to equal magic for an awful lot of it. And
yeah,
that
which is fine in the novels, because in the novel you don't see anything that happens behind the scenes. We don't see the game makers putting things into play, and there's a very stupid bit at the end of the film where something is conjured up literally out of the dirt.
Yeah,
and the novel we don't see that. That to me was a step too far and completely ruined the end of the film for me.
Yeah,
that was just a bit of nonsense as far as I was concerned.
It was literally, we need to end the film now. Let's throw in some big cougary bud things. Which
is in the book, but it just appears in the arena. It's the origin of it isn't explained.
Yeah.
And it probably would have been served better that way in the film, as opposed to this amazing, magical... I'm prepared to invest myself in the rest of the technology in the film, but not that particular part.
Yeah.
Where we can summon beasts just from the earth at will. I find that a bit odd.
Yeah, I was also very much taken out of the film at that point too, other than thinking, this is rather silly. It's looking at them, The design of them, if they'd had big sort of horizontal horns, they should have been talking about gatekeepers and the keymaster and Zul.
Yeah.
And also like the dogs from Ghostbusters.
Disturbingly, in the novel, these creatures have the eyes of the deceased contestants.
Well, that's quite creepy sounding.
Yes, it is quite creepy. And perhaps the film would have been well served by that. But I don't know, maybe that just would have freaked the kids out too much.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you say the eyes, as in like their eyes, where are the eyes of the deceased contestants?
Mm.
Sounds quite macabre. I'm not quite sure how you'd explain that in film. It wouldn't necessarily be obvious.
Yeah, it's a shame that kind of undercuts the ending, because I did actually quite like the kind of final showdown of it, is as these things go, quite clever, I thought. But it's just undercut by the fact that you got there by summoning magic, which is a bit off.
Exactly.
Overall, I think it's quite a positive entry. If not looking forward to the next one, I'm certainly not going to avoid it, as I would do if it was, say, Twilight.
I think we can all agree with that. Now, Drew, I know you have prepared for the cold light of day. Would you like to tell us a bit about that?
If I must. Okay, so, I watched a film not enormously long ago, in which something happens to a young man's family, and this young man must then go on the run. He subsequently learns, much to his surprise, that his father's a secret agent. He receives some mysterious guffin from his father, which his father had, which he must protect from some corrupt secret agents, and then deliver that to the right people, and he must become an arse-kicking action hero overnight to do so. A notable presence in that film was Sigourney Weaver, another secret agent of unclear allegiance, in a black power suit. Now, rather than repeat myself, I'm tempted just to point our listeners in the direction of episode 86 of our podcast, because that's where we covered that film, which was called Abduction, and The Cold Light of Day is the same film. I mean, it even has Sigourney Weaver as a secret agent of unclear allegiance in the same damn suit. Surprisingly, though, even though this film, The Cold Light of Day, features Bruce Willis, it is by far the poorer of the two. Perhaps because in Abduction, Twilight star Taylor Lautner was performing above expectations. Perhaps simply because it was first. But this is a B-grade thriller with some C-grade performances from A-grade stars who seemingly just fancied a holiday in Spain. The Cold Light of Day is it's generic and below average in every conceivable way. It's entirely, utterly unremarkable. Although, clearly, not strictly true since I'm remarking on it right now. That's a bit of a mindfuck. None of its elements are completely awful, but there's just nothing there that you've not seen before, including illogical plot conveniences like a 3-ton Range Rover outhandling an Audi A1, and Henry Cavill losing enough blood to kill most people but seemingly no more affected by it than being a bit faint and pale for a couple of hours. And as I've hinted, most of the cast seem to have only joined the film to do a bit of sightseeing. Henry Cavill's performance doesn't bode well for next year's Man of Steel either, and Superman is a really, really dull character that really needs a charismatic performance to make engaging. And if The Cold Light of Day is any guide, then charisma is not his forte. However, as all of us here at The One Liner know, Bruce Willis is capable of extremely charismatic performances, and he phones in his performance in this film. So keep an open mind on Cavill for now, but I'd strongly recommend against seeing The Cold Light of Day. It's below bog standard thriller, and there are oodles and oodles of films in the same genre out there that are considerably better.
Boo. Scott, did you check it out?
Yes, I can't remember why, though. Possibly we were trying to get into something better. I can't quite remember. Possibly we were just attracted by the cast. It's not that often that Bruce Willis is in a terrible film. It's not that often that Sigourney Weaver's in a terrible film, and Henry Cavill at least is at the novelty factor. I don't think I've ever actually seen him in anything, but as I say, the next Superman's worth a look. But no, they've, as Drew says, it's definitely holiday time, and the A-list is, it's one of these bizarre films that pops up every couple of years, like Righteous Kill from a few years back, where somehow it's like very clearly at best just scraping into direct-to-DVD release that somehow has attracted a massive stars, a massively talented cast who can't really do anything with it, and it just sort of stumbles along, and well, it's not dreadful, it's very, very, very mediocre. It's as mediocre can be. I freely admit I hadn't actually bothered to check it out up until this very moment, but the director, this is Maburakel Merci, who probably isn't that familiar, but he did do in 2008 JCVD, the best Jean-Claude Van Damme film by a good long while, and actually one of the best films of that year. So I'm, if anything, more disappointed in The Cold Light of Day than I was half an hour ago. And that's saying something. Yeah, definitely not one that's worth watching. Oh, if you've not seen it, dig out JCVD instead. It's a much more interesting, more imaginative, and far better handled film than The Cold Light of Day is.
Absolutely. Those bastards. If we must deal with a slightly older crap Bruce Willis film, let us talk of a slightly more recent Bruce Willis film of which I have much higher expectations, and that, Scott, would be Moonrise Kingdom.
Ah, Moonrise Kingdom. As you would immediately ascertain from sitting through about four frames of it, a Wes Anderson film. I've always liked Wes Anderson films. I don't think he's done one that I've disliked.
Fantastic Mr. Fox was disappointing, I think, but I wouldn't say it was bad.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think it's after The Life Aquatic, he's been on a bit of a downward trend. I don't think he's done anything that's actually bad, but I wasn't that fond of The Darjeeling Limited, and I wasn't that fond of Fantastic Mr. Fox. But there's one thing that you can say about all those films, is it's immediately apparent that you are watching a Wes Anderson film. He's an auteur in the sense that there's almost nothing of these days. There's very few directors that whose output you can sort of immediately clock as being, okay, this is definitely a Wes Anderson film. It has that sense of style, the sense of pacing, the sense of delivery, which I personally I'm very fond of. I can equally understand why people would loathe it. Moonrise Kingdom, however, is slightly unusual in that it is one of the least Wes Anderson-y films since perhaps Rushmore. He's toned in a lot of the particularly whimsical elements, is the, I suppose, the usual way of describing it, of things like The Life Aquatic, which I loved, but you know, there's only so many toy submarines you can look at in a film before you start wondering what you're doing with your life. And this has that. While it still has the same kind of character and the same sort of spirit to it, it's reined in a lot more. It feels a lot more grounded, while at the same time, quite obviously being a Wes Anderson joint, if you will. The plot of it is, as I guess, kind of usual with Wes Anderson films, far from the driving force of the film. There's a pair of young, I believe 13-year-old kids who are both kind of outcasts. One kid has lost his parents. He's kind of working, he's an orphan who takes part in the scouts, he's a keen scout, who eventually meets the daughter of Bill Murray, who's in a bit of a dysfunctional family, and they kind of form a bond and eventually decide to run off together across a small New England island, and they kind of go on the lam, which gives us a strange kind of cross between, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and Twilight. Why not? I seem to be comparing every film to Twilight today, which is not a good thing for anyone.
Well, but as long as you're comparing this being better than Twilight, though.
Yeah, it's much,
that's
much
the
better.
Right direction, at least.
It certainly doesn't avoid the usual Anderson things of not being entirely grounded in realism. It's all a bit perhaps technicolor. The dialogue is obviously not what a 13-year-old would be saying at that particular point in their life, but it's very sharply scripted. I do like, there's lots of lovely little bits of wordplay. But the main thing about that you have to love about this film is the characters. There's so many just lovely little well-realized and kind of well-actualized little caricature. A lot of the usual stalwarts of the Anderson regime, guys like Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray, of course, guys like that, and a few kind of newer faces that I don't think I've seen in these before, like Harvey Keitel and Bruce Willis, all of whom put in just immensely charming performances. It's a very charming film. It's not something that is ever going to turn anyone's heads. If you've looked at a Wes Anderson film before and hated it, then this will not change your mind about it. It's not so different that you would perhaps want to sort of reassess your views of the man. But because it has toned down a lot of these things, perhaps more similar in tone to the likes of Rushmore than his later works. So if you're kind of on the fence, if you think that Anderson maybe pushes it a little bit too far for you, then this is perhaps a film to check out. I absolutely loved Moonrise Kingdom. I think it is. It's perhaps too early to say if it's going to be Wes Anderson's best film, but it's certainly Wes Anderson's best film since, well, probably since the year 2000. I liked it an awful lot, and I've liked, of course, many other Wes Anderson films an awful lot, but I really liked this. I think it's certainly above Darjeeling Limited. Fantastic Mr. Fox is kind of a slightly weird one. It's certainly better than that, but I probably rate it above The Royal Tenenbaums and Life Aquatic. So,
good grief. High
praise indeed. Pretty high mark.
It doesn't seem to be quite as well received, I think, generally, as these other two films, but I think that's because it has been a bit more, okay, mainstream's not quite the right term, but it's certainly tamping itself down more towards the mainstream than the usual kind of Anderson extreme quirkiness. And I think in this case that's really pulled off. Lovely performances both from the two young leads and the guys like Ed Norton and Bill Murray, obviously Bruce Willis and Frances McDormand. Even though they have very small roles, they do stand out as real characters, and they feel they're very memorable in a way that few other films do, which is, again, I suppose, a bit of a Anderson trademark. Highly recommend Moonrise Kingdom. If you've even the slightest bit of love for Wes Anderson's previous work, you will get an awful lot of joy out of Moonrise Kingdom, I believe.
Excellent, eh? When I read the IMDb plot synopsis of This Must Be the Place, I instantly recognise it as something I might have written in one of my more bored, drunken moments. Drew, would you like to explain to the listeners exactly why that is?
This Must Be the Place, this is a bit of an odd one. I'll try to describe the plot such as it is, and such as I remember it many months later. Sean Penn is an ageing rock star who lives in Dublin. with his American wife, Frances McDormand, who also happens to be a firefighter. He spends most of his day wandering around with makeup on, a shock of mad dark hair, looking morose, speaking a squeaky voice, and meeting young goth girls to talk and act fatherly towards them in various shopping malls. And if that sounds really, really bizarre, then it's because it is. It's not quite clear what's... There's some hint of a tragedy, perhaps, in his background, or just that this guy never found himself, but he loves his wife deeply, she loves him, so all's not lost. But when he hears news that his estranged father has died, he travels to the US by boat because he can't fly, so he misses the funeral because he has to take a boat to the United States, but meets his family, learns a wee bit about more about his dad, who hadn't spoken to in about 20 years, and then, in the most obvious next turn of events, decides to start trekking across the United States on a road trip to find the Nazi camp guard who tortured his dad at Auschwitz or somewhere like that, of course, obviously. So then it just turns into him being morose, wearing makeup with a shock of dark hair, speaking in a strange squeaky voice, wandering across America and borrowing people's cars. And I can't really be more
cohesive. Let's just reiterate the fact that you like this.
I did like it. It's, I don't want to give you much more of the plot, because there's not a plot other than that after finding out his father's died, he goes looking for this guy to punish him, the man that tormented him in a concentration camp. It's quite hard to categorise. It's not a road movie in any conventional sense. It's, oh, jeez. I'm very much struggling to describe it, and I kind of don't want to, because I think you need to see it to appreciate it. And it sounds odd, and...
It is.
Yes, because it is. You almost immediately want to dislike Sean Penn, because he looks like such a prat, and his voice, you think, is almost instantly going to set your teeth on edge. But it turns out it's another one of those things. Sean Penn may be a prat, but he can act hell of a well, and he's really compelling. Great support from Frances McDormand. It's really... odd and quirky and hard to categorise, and definitely isn't going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it's also really funny and kind of sweet and heartwarming and delightfully odd. I can't unreservedly recommend it, because you have to be a certain type of person, I think, to appreciate this, but certainly at least two of the three of us here are. whether all three would be if you saw it as well, Craig, I don't know, but I know I'm describing this terribly, but I can't really think how to do justice to it. You really need to see it, but I would recommend it anyway. Scott, can you do any better at doing justice to it?
I won't be seeing anything with Sean Prick Penn in it anytime soon, but yeah. I must admit I'm quite intrigued by the synopsis of it.
This did come at a rather low point of my tolerance for Penn, who's normally a bit of a dick anyway, but was being particularly prickish about the Falklands at the same time as this was released.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And yeah, so I wasn't really expecting to go into this. And when you see this guy wandering around as basically a cross between an aging Robert Smith and Mrs. Doubtfire, it's I was not well placed to start liking the film, but it somehow pulls out the bag. It says it's got writers. I don't think it does. This it kind of has the impression of something that has just been kind of it is
unsubstantiated claim that it was written.
Well, it kind of ties in with the this must be the place, because as the Talking Heads would have you, they're making it up as they go along, and that seems to be more or less what's happening here. And incidentally, you've really got to like the Talking Heads to like this, because you will hear This Must Be the Place about eight different times during the course of this film.
And also, I'd forgotten it, as if it wasn't slightly odd enough, it just grinds to a halt halfway through to have a concert by the Talking Head, or David Byrne anyway.
Yeah, and to have Sean Penn in his one apparently contractually obliged must-act moment, where the rest of it seems to be kind of fairly naturalistic. There's one point where he just starts bawling for no good reason at David Byrne, of all people. which kind of somehow works, because it's all tied in with such amazing nonsense throughout the whole course
David,
of the film that it just works.
Why will no one else call it Malvinas?
it's not far off that. I like the way that Cheyenne, as he's puzzlingly called, his past doesn't, as I say, doesn't really get explained. You're not quite sure what's happened to him that's put him on such a strange and divergent course from the rest of his family. But somehow that works. It's all just very charming in a way that you would never really expect. And especially once he starts going Nazi hunting, he still manages to be quite charming about it. And even though he's going about with this ridiculous sort of... He looks like someone who's been taking a lot of acid at some point in his life and is now no longer quite in touch with reality. Yet, despite that and his stupid voice, he's actually probably making more sense than anyone else in the film. he's the one who seems more grounded than anyone else, despite all obvious evidence to the contrary. I cannot explain for the life of me why this film works, but it does. It's not something you can really, as Drew says, you can't really recommend anyone go out and pay money for, because it does seem to be such a hit and miss. You've got to be so tuned into this film's particular vibe, and I really can't think of anything that it's much like to try and help you decide whether you would like that or not. So it is the sort of film that I'd have to kind of say, you're going to have to wait until this pops up on terrestrial telly or something you can get without really paying an awful lot for, rather than risk that you waste your, if you go to the cinema, best part of £10, much the same for a rental, I suppose, these days. It's the sort of film that if you did have to gamble your money on, I probably would advise against it. But I really enjoyed it.
It's something which in 9 months' time I'll see it on Netflix.
Yeah,
I'll
exactly.
Hover over it. I'll go and then I'm more likely to pick something with Danny Dyer in it instead.
That would be a bad idea. I mean, I don't know what Danny Dyer film you propose to watch, but I can guarantee you it's going to be much worse than this film.
So until that man stops being a prick about the Falklands, I will not endorse him or his work in any way, shape, or form. Prick. So, from one overacting knob end to another, Johnny Depp in Dark Shadows, Scott.
Isn't that almost all you need to say about the film?
I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Dark Shadows is another film that's been horribly missold to me, and I'm very upset about this one. The trailer actually looked quite fun. It has Johnny Depp as a colonial-era vampire, a fellow who's cursed with vampirism. He's buried alive and eventually is dug back up in the 70s to find that the world is now a very different place after being asleep for 100-something years. So he immediately tries to get back in touch with his family, and he finds that his previous massive fisheries canning empire has been overshadowed by the witch who banished him, who cursed him with vampirism in the first place. The problem with the film is that it is kind of sold on the basis that it's going to be a kind of very high camp comedy about this man out of time stepping back and trying to readjust himself with a world that is, I think it's actually closer to 200 years away from where he was born, and trying to acclimatise to this new one. It's kind of sold as a comedy. Now, it's certainly very light-hearted, but the problem is that it kind of takes itself all a bit seriously. It's all built around the rivalry between Barnabas Collins, played by Johnny Depp, and Ava Green's Angelique Bouchard, the witch who doomed them to this fate. And it thinks that you should care about this battle, and it is very difficult to do so because it's such a stupid film. There's not an awful lot to really sink your teeth into about Dark Shadows. There's some moments where it falls into this vibe where it really does quite work, mainly most of the moments you've already seen in the trailer, but there's a few other parts where it's got lovely little scenes where it's Johnny Depp and is still talking like he's coming out of the 18th century to a bunch of hippies who are all suitably stereotyped up, and then apologising profusely before having to eat them all. And there's a few moments like that that are actually, you know, despite the subject matter obviously, turn out to be quite funny.
You sick son of a bitch.
I'm such a bastard. However, the rest of it just kind of falls a bit flat. There's far too much invested in trying to make you care about this rivalry, as I say, between Johnny Depp and Eva Green. No one's really up to the task. I like Johnny Depp well enough, but he's just in such a silly role, you can't really build him an awful lot of empathy for him, and Eva Green is just a bit of a charisma black hole. Nothing much really happens with her. So there's a lot of kind of slack that the supporting cast tries quite valiantly to pick up, people like Michelle Pfeiffer and John Lee Miller as various folks who are, you know, either carrying on the family name and variously slime balls as in Johnny Lee Miller's character. But there's just not really an awful lot to it. It's not funny enough to be work as a comedy, and there's nothing like enough drama in there to work as a drama. So it kind of falls halfway between these stools where it's kind of difficult to care about one way or the other. Tim Burton directs, as you've probably gathered if you've seen any of the trailer. Again, Tim Burton, another auteur, it's obviously very easy to notice you're in front of a Tim Burton film when you're sat in front of it. If anything, this is perhaps less of a Tim Burton film than anything I've seen of his lately. It's almost more ordinary in a great many places, but it just seems to have been given a kind of standing and a budget that really doesn't deserve from either the plot or anything that it's actually managed to deliver. It's far from the worst film I've seen, but there's just really not much to it, and it's one of these films that is based on a property that is both so old and so American that you're not going to have any residual goodwill for it either.
It's one of these films that features Alice Cooper as himself.
Which can never be a good thing. Wayne's World pulled it off, but I think that's about it. There really just isn't an awful lot to it. I went into this expecting a comedy, and what I got was a kind of slightly comedic drama that has nothing like enough drama to sustain the 113-minute running time of it. It drags in an awful lot of places. There's moments where you go for ages without anything particularly interesting or funny happening, or indeed anything dramatic happening. There's just really very little to this film. I'm not surprised, of course, that they try to remake some old property. That's very much the motive of Hollywood for the past decade or so, but there's really just nothing in here, and why it was made, and why it managed to attract Johnny Depp, who presumably would have his choice of any film, and Tim Burton, who's probably got much the same options as well. Why this film's been made, I don't know. It's not particularly good, and I don't recommend anyone go and see it.
Yeah, do one Burton. Some consider Sacha Baron Cohen to be funny, though most would agree probably in small doses. 90 minutes is not a small dose, Drew the Dictator.
It's 83 minutes.
Yes, it is actually shorter than you're saying, Craig.
Thank heavens for small mercies.
Unlike, for instance, Bruno or Borat, this isn't a sort of pseudo-documentary. It's more of your straight-up comedy. Sacha Baron Cohen plays the Colonel Gaddafi-like General Admiral Aladdin, who is coming to the United States to visit the United Nations and gets betrayed by his trusted advisor and then has to stop his country being made better, because that would be a terrible thing. Very strange. It's just a series of gags, really. The plot isn't really relevant. It's how many guys can Sacha Baron Cohen get out of being anti-Semitic or just rude or misogynistic, basically. And it's going to come down to, quite simply, whether you like Sacha Baron Cohen or not. I found it quite funny. It's not the best film I've ever seen, and certainly it could be argued that he's suffering from the law of diminishing returns, but I think he gets a far better return from this than he did from Bruno. It's a comedy with Sacha Baron Cohen. You know what you're getting. If you like him, you'll probably find it's quite funny but not brilliant. Don't really think it merits a lot more than that to say about it. Would you disagree, Scott?
Not wildly. I liked it well enough to kind of recommend it. If you've liked any of Cohen's work previously, then go and see it. It's one of these exercises in pushing certain limits just about as far as you can get them. Well, you're trying to find the limits of what people are going to find funny in a mainstream audience, like how many abortion jokes can you get away with?
Mainstream stuff like that.
It's obviously been pitched to a mainstream audience, and it is displaying his unique and somewhat twisted line of humour.
Yeah. Now,
there are some genuinely really funny, really raw bits in it, like, that would stand up in most films, but it's the fact that so much of it's stretched over the running time that it's just repeats itself a bit.
How telling is it? We have a film where Sacha Baron Cohen is playing the dictator, a mass murdering maniac, and yet, somehow, Ben Kingsley is still the bad guy. This is what it's come to. It's funny enough. I suppose I should give some credit to Anna Faris as the kind of straight woman in this instance, because it's a thankless task that she's been given. But somehow it kind of works. Just the sort of extreme misogyny that plays up to in a lot of it kind of works far better just because Anna Faris is around. Its problem is, if anything, that it has to conform to a plot. The fact that, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen's trying to get his country back and such like, and the kind of gags have to kind of conform around this contrived speech to the United Nations and things like that, is probably where it falls down more than anything else. That bit's just both pointless because it's not funny in a comedy film. If you're not trying to be funny, then something wrong with you. And it's not like I'm going to care more about this character or not, because he's obviously so completely unsympathetic that you're not going to do that anyway. So why are you doing this? That's just wasting time. But it's funny enough. There's enough good lines in there that I kind of like to kind of recommend it to anyone who likes that style of comedy, Sacha Baron Cohen's style of comedy. It's obviously incredibly extreme, but it works slightly more than it doesn't. It has not, however, made me want to go and see any more Sacha Baron Cohen films, unless I'm given some kind of confidence that it's going to be massively different to what he's been doing for the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, that's quite right. Can't see where it could possibly go now, other than to just be doing the same film again.
Yeah, this is now the kind of the limit. I think you probably can't push this style of comedy anymore without it just being, you know, simply not funny. There's already moments in here where you kind of go, well, that's just deliberately offensive rather than funny, and you're trying to get away with it because it happens to be in a comedy film.
With Sacha Baron Cohen is that I don't find his comedy particularly clever.
The one scene where I think it might be trying to be clever is appalling, where he goes in this, a very clumsy, heavy-handed comparison of American policy of late with what he was doing as a dictator, and it kind of screams like, look, this is my attempt to legitimise myself as a satire.
Yeah. Listen, topical, yes, but it doesn't fit because none of the rest of the film's like that.
Yeah, it's kind of bolted on. It's like, you can't excuse yourself that way. If you just want to make a bad taste comedy, fine, go for it, balls out, and don't try and excuse yourself with this kind of nonsense. But I can let that slide. It was only 2 minutes out of the 83-minute running time, so what the hell. But Cohen needs to sort of step up and change. He can't keep making this sort of film again and again. He needs to either retire quietly with his vast stacks of cash that he's already made, or go gently into the night.
On then to The Avengers, or if you live here with us in the UK, the stupidly titled Avengers Assemble. Because there is always the danger that you'll mistake Scarlett Johansson for Joanna Lumley.
Joanna Lumley, Diana Rigg, Uma Thurman.
Scott.
So, The Avengers, as I'm going to call it, sees the superhero team of Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, Black Widow, Hawkeye, who you've all seen before, and in this instance, the Hulk, who, well, we've seen before, but not in this instance, as Mark Ruffalo takes over portraying the big green fella. The plot, well, there is a plot, but it's not particularly interesting or relevant to almost anything. It's puzzlingly, as it may be, given that at least four of these characters have had origin stories before, it's another origin stories, this one being of how the team kind of gets together to protect humanity against all sorts of intergalactic enemies. In this instance, the big bad is Loki, who you'll remember as the particularly crap bad guy from Thor. And
that's an understatement.
He's still a particularly crap bad guy in this one, although it's actually less important here for reasons I suppose we'll get onto. He turns out to be basically being the sort of second string bad guy to someone else who you'll presumably see in Avengers 2 when they get round to making it. The characters you're probably more or less familiar with, obviously Robert Downey Jr. returns as Iron Man, who's still quite charismatic because he's Robert Downey Jr. He basically does the same shtick, and it still works quite well because he's Robert Downey Jr. and he can get with pretty much anything since his recovery from cocaine addiction a while back. Chris Evans returns as Captain America, who's still bloody boring, but kind of makes much more sense in this film. Being the only sort of trained military guy, he kind of assumes a sort of leadership role, which actually makes sense in this little group. He's somehow given some legitimacy here, which he never had in the Captain America film, which I don't think we spoke about, but really wasn't very good.
No, he was brilliant as the silly performer with the wings and his hat.
Less said about that, the better. Thor, Chris Hemsworth, well, he knows how to be tall and muscular, and that's, I think, pretty much all you need to be for Thor, so I suppose that's fine. I don't think Thor's the sort of character that's very interesting to follow for a whole film, as the film Thor proved, but as a kind of supporting character, he's actually quite good.
Does Thor suffer from the same sort of problems as Superman did? It's like, basically, you're a god.
Yeah.
What's going to defeat you?
The plot of this is, I suppose I should cover it in some small detail. Nick Fury, who is Samuel L. Jackson, obviously, as S.H.I.E.L.D. has brought together this team of superheroes as a kind of backup plan when his first plan of making good weapons fails. And basically, it's come to S.H.I.E.L.D.'s attention as a defenders of humanity in general, as a general sort of government secret agency kind of thing, that they've come to the attention of intergalactic bad guys, and it's would become prudent to try and defend the Earth. And this is the essential point of the Avengers, a group of superheroes that can band together to save us in times of particular crisis. This time it is formed by Loki, who is given a big stick which apparently grants him ultimate power over something and command of an army of people. I'm not sure it's ever actually said in the film, it's just an army of weird looking Chitauris, completely characterless bad guys who might as well be running around with boxes on their head for all the characterisation they're given. They're basically just a cannon fodder for the good guys. Somehow it works quite well, mainly because it actually gives some people things to do that I'd otherwise kind of questioned why they were there. Scarlett Johansson is obviously just there as eye candy, as Black Widow, who's a spy essentially, but a spy wearing a catsuit. Ooh. But guys like Hawkeye, played by Jeremy Renner, who had a bit part in the Thor film as well, you kind of wondered what these guys would do. I mean, if you've got Iron Man and Captain America and the Hulk and Thor, why do they need a guy with a bow and arrow? What possible use is he going to be? But it turns out they've actually given him a kind of reasonable role as a kind of mole in the team, thanks to some alien influences and all this sort of nonsense. The characters that I kind of wondered why on earth were they there were given a pretty good reason to be there. The main reason that I kind of liked a lot of Avengers Assemble in the early running was that in Mark Ruffalo, they've finally found a Hulk who actually works. I mean, I think I'm maybe one of the only people on the planet that actually liked the first Hulk film of the recent superhero revival, the Ang Lee version.
That was certainly better than the Louis Leterrier one.
I actually genuinely like that first Hulk film.
Yeah, I didn't think it was all that terrible.
It doesn't fit in with the kind of superhero action genre that is the formula that's been churned out after it. It kind of sticks out like the big green sore thumb in that one. But if anyone thinks that that is somehow a worse film than the Ed Norton version, then they're crazy. That was a boring disaster of all kinds. But in this, Bart Gruffalo actually plays a very a convincing Bruce Banner. And also they've managed to make the Hulk work. The Hulk's too dull a character, I think. The whole Jekyll and Hyde thing can't really sustain a whole film because we know what Jekyll and Hyde is. This kind of works a bit more as a kind of supporting character and trying to keep the Hulk in line a bit by talking up with Bruce Banner. There's a great interplay between Ruffalo and Downey Jr. as guys. Whereas everyone else sort of considers Dr. Bruce Banner as a threat, Tony Stark's the only one that kind of treats him as an intellectually equal. And it's that chemistry between the two makes a kind of great play in how the Hulk can control himself when he's in a team situation with these other guys. And that's really well handled. An awful lot of the interplay in the script between these characters is handled very well, which I suppose I'm going to have to give credit to Joss Whedon, which is not something I like doing an awful lot because I don't get Joss Whedon. I don't like almost anything that he's done. I don't get Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Everyone loves all the films that he's done. Everyone loves Firefly. Everyone loves Serenity and all that kind of thing. And I've just never liked any of it. I just don't get him. But somehow this, I can kind of see why they've picked him. He's the perfect guy for this. There's a few instances where it's kind of pushed a little bit too far down that kind of Whedon-esque dialogue where he's, you know, just a little bit too self-conscious and superficial about all that's going on, a little bit too blasé about it. But for like 98% of the film, it works really well. And it does seem like this team of equals sort of joshing about each other at the same time as managing to build a kind of believable drama and chemistry between them all. And really, that's why it works. The plot, the action, all that sort of stuff is, well, the plot's almost non-existent. The plot is basically Loki has come to cause trouble and these guys must stop them. The rest of the plot sentence is pretty dreadful. It's definitely not there to kind of help the film. It's just something that happens over the course of it. It's just a really good way of bringing these characters together and having them form a believable team that I've not seen Whedon himself do. I know ensemble scripting is supposed to be his big deal. That's why people love Buffy. It's why people love Firefly. I've never really quite got that with any of that, but somehow it works here far better than anything else, and he's managed to take characters that I really didn't care that much about at all in their main films. I mean, Captain America is really boring. Thor was really boring for the most part. There's bad characters. There's quite boring characters to watch. But here he's managed to make them kind of bounce off each other in really interesting ways and really gives the film a bit of spark, a bit of life to it. The action is, you know, good. As good a superhero action film as I've seen in terms of the effects and all that kind of stuff. How well that ages, who can say? It's the sort of thing that maybe we'll look at 10 years down the line and wonder what were we thinking with all these Iron Man films and all that kind of stuff. It's just CG things hitting other CG things. How well it ages, as I say, not sure, but in the current cinematic landscape, its effects work and all that kind of stuff as a spectacle, which is partly the point of tentpole movies. It's as good as anything I've seen. The action's plentiful and for the most part quite convincing. It looks quite good. It works very well as a character piece, I think. That's what kept me interested in what I think will perhaps have this age a bit better. I still think Iron Man has worked far better than any other the superhero action films because Robert Downey Jr. is a better character actor than most people who would be cast in this kind of thing. And this and Ruffalo kind of really does help kind of raise the game a little bit more. It makes it a bit more believable as a character piece. I very much liked Avengers Assemble now. Whether I'll be saying the same thing, you know, a few years down the line, I don't know. But in terms of it just being a fun way to spend your evening and £8 or whatever of your money for it, it's an awful lot of fun. It's quite funny in a number of places. It's scripted tightly enough that I can see why these characters are kind of forming bonds or not, as the case may be at that particular point in time. And it all seems to make sense. It kind of works in a grand scheme of things, perhaps far better than you would expect for such a diverse number of characters coming together and basically just fighting a bunch of nameless enemies. It works far better than it honestly has any right to. So, gets a thumbs up from me.
A film which I would desperately love to see is The Raid, Scott.
The Raid? You might not think it from the director. Director Gareth Evans. Now, if there's a more Welsh name than Gareth Evans, I don't know what it would be. It'd probably have a lot more vowels in it, I suppose. But it's a film from Indonesia, of all places, and it is perhaps the best action film I've seen this millennium. There's really nothing to say about the plot. A group of Indonesian special forces are told to raid a particular tower block which has been inhabited by a drug baron who is offering rent of his slum to all the bad guys in society, and any criminal wants to say they can get up to what they like to without any particular interference. And because he is so feared and has bribed the police so well, it will essentially be untouched. It's a tower block where there is no law. However, for whatever whatever reason, we're introduced to a SWAT team who have been told, right, go in and get this drug baron at whatever cost you like. Essentially, that's the film. You join the raw recruit Rama, who's apparently his first outing with the SWAT team, who has a pregnant wife, which is basically your hook for hoping that he gets back alive, but it quickly becomes irrelevant. With the rest of his team, he goes in to try and extract this guy. They start off trying to go in all stealthy, sneaky. That works about as well as you'd expect, and after about 20 minutes, the bad guys realise what's up and call an all points alarm, and so they have to fight their way up an entire 15-storey tower block full of bad guys to try and meet the bad guy and his two lieutenants, Andy and Mad Dog. Plot-wise, yeah, really nothing more to it than that. However, the action in this film is immense. I don't think I've seen anything so impressive. Although it's a SWAT team, basically, it kind of revolves down to just being a martial arts film at the end of the day. However, the only thing I can compare it to is the sort of first couple of Tony Jaa films in terms of the kind of impact, the skill, and the sheer pleasure in watching this sort of thing going on. Lots of really fantastic action, and crucially, it's shot incredibly well. It's, you know, for almost no other reason than it is one of the few films where you have these kung fu moves going on and someone's decided to just take a camera and lock it off and just have it watch people display this incredible amount of skill, rather than trying to, you know, keep jumping around shaky cam style and intercutting all these sort of 40 cuts every second techniques that are, for a while, were just endemic in this sort of field. Because of that, it shows an incredible amount of skill and an incredible amount of talent that the guys who are fighting actually have. It works tremendously well. It's incredibly well paced. There's never a dull moment in any of this. It has to be the only time that I can remember that I've been sat at a film in an audience where people are literally going, oh, as they see the results of some of these violent actions. There's some just tremendous scenes of your bone-crunching brutality. It's not a film for the faint of heart. Well, it's not particularly gory. There's lots of moments that are just, you know, you will watch and feel the pain of the impact of some of these things going happen. I mean, there's a...
That should be the tagline. Watch and feel the pain.
Maybe it's just, this is the sort of film that I generally don't get to see in a big screen and don't have to watch on telly, but just some of the impacts that you see here is like someone getting thrown down a stairwell and landing on like a banister two stories down and kind of just bending in half at the back. And the whole audience just went, ow! And sort of, it just looks so convincing. It just looks so great. And it just all fits so perfectly well. Central plot, essentially pointless. There's some last minute intrigue with, obviously, someone's going to get betrayed at the end because, well, that's what you do in this kind of film, but it's certainly not its strongest suit as the plot or any of the characters in it. But what it does manage to do is build up a good level of sympathy with the main character, the protagonist of the piece, and also, puzzlingly, manages to build up a decent amount of empathy for two of the bad guys in it. The actual two lieutenants become relatively fully formed characters, and when it gets to the end, one of the bad guys' lieutenants, who is basically just portrayed as someone who likes fighting, winds up having to fight two good guys, which has to be one of the few times where I've seen that work as a piece that manages to build sympathy for everyone that's fighting in there. Two good guys it is fighting for who are almost overmatched by this one bad guy, and it somehow works in a way that you would never really expect it to. Normally it's two bad guys fighting one good guy, which is easy to kind of empathise with because at that point the person you're supposed to be empathising with is the underdog, whereas in this one it somehow managed to sort of flip that, which is one of the few times I've seen that, and it works incredibly well. It actually manages to make you feel some empathy for all of the characters that are fighting in it, which makes it a far more effective fighting scene. So it's got a lot of imagination, both in its action and the way it's sort of structured. The central plot, okay, generic, run-of-the-mill, nothing much to say about that, but the action in this film is tremendous. If you've been, like me, and I suppose like everyone else in this podcast, jonesing for the days of like John Woo or these other, you know, really hardcore action films that just don't seem to get made anymore, you've really got to see The Raid. It is that in spades and possibly better than anything I've seen before. Whether I just like this so much because I've not seen anything like it for so long, maybe that's the case, but I enjoyed The Raid more than almost any film I've seen in the last couple of years. Certainly in terms of an action film, it just takes no prisoners and is happy to throw all sorts of chaos at you. If you've any sympathy at all for the martial arts genre, you've really got to track down The Raid and give it a watch. Fantastic stuff. Really loved it.
Jings. Unless you've been hiding under a rock for the last couple of months, you can't have helped but notice that Sir Ridders is back with what he himself describes as a loose prequel to Alien, his 1979 film?
79, I think. 78 or 79.
which of course many would agree redefined a genre. It's taken him almost 30 years to come back full circle and broach a topic he considered more important than most of them, which had been skipped over by more recent iterations of the Alien franchise, that being the presence in the first film of what has become known amongst fans as the Space Jockey, or which the rest of us will refer to as the Engineer. Scott, I wasn't quite sure. I tried to avoid as much pre-match hype as I could with Prometheus because it was one of the few films I was actually genuinely looking forward to this year. I myself have not been wholly fulfilled. How did you find the experience?
I was roundly disappointed by it, I think. It's become clear, I think, you know, from what you've been saying there and a few other things, that what Ridley Scott seems to think was the general hook behind the whole Aliens universe and franchise, what he finds the most interesting thing in that is, I do not think what everyone else found so interesting about everything that happened in the films from
there's,
there
there's
and
there
and
after. There's probably a reason why it hasn't been revisited.
I was actually thinking about this. There was a time just before they started making the Aliens vs. Predator films, I think, where I don't think it was Ridley Scott. I think actually at the time it was James Cameron who was, you know, mooted with very seriously contemplating coming back to do something in the series to continue that way.
He was supposed to have been doing Alien 5 and apparently Arnie was going to be in it. I definitely remember that story from a few years ago.
I mean, you know, God knows how well this, if this was actually real or whatever, you take rumours for what they're worth. It's, it just seems strange at the time that when that kind of either fell through or whatever happened and Aliens vs. Predator was made, I know a lot of people were spitting teeth about that kind of thing, you know, how can you desecrate these franchises and whatnot, but at that point I was kind of okay with it. If you've decided that no one's going to make any more, you know, real Aliens film or real Predator films, you know, why not do a kind of dream match kind of mashup thing and just have that play out? I mean, the idea itself isn't a bad one. The execution obviously was. The Aliens vs. Predator films are certainly not worth watching, but what I found more puzzling is that whoever made those films, the Aliens vs. Predator franchise, actually has a better idea of why people watch the Alien films than Ridley Scott does, which I found terrifying. Prometheus is a puzzlement to me. It put me in mind of, I don't even know if anyone's seen this apart from me, if anyone watched Starship Troopers 2, Hero of the Federation, is, you know, Starship Troopers 2 was essentially a direct-to-video or DVD film that was had nothing to do at all with the Starship Troopers franchise, that was at the last minute retrofitted into the universe, and that's kind of what Prometheus feels like to me. There's like maybe an hour, or it felt an awful lot longer. I'm just looking, I'm surprised to find out that it's only 124 minutes.
Yeah.
It felt an awful lot longer to me. For the life of me, it felt like it was about 2 hours of preamble where they're doing the sort of sci-fi thing of asking one of these grand what-if questions, but doing it in a completely ham-fisted way where it basically answers its own question in the very first scene.
Yeah.
And then tries to riff about it for a while, and it just doesn't make any sense, and it's just so front-loaded with stupid. I suppose I'm not spoiling anything here by saying that these, the engineers which you spoke of, these big, what are they, 9 foot tall people that look a bit like a kind of albino version of Seth from Street Fighter 4.
Yeah. Seth's Cornish cousin.
They came down to Earth and ate what looks to be like a tub of caviar, then exploded into a fountain, which apparently caused life on Earth.
See, I took it to be Marmite, purely because you either like it or it kills you and seeds life on a planet.
That seems to be its central point. It's asking a question of, what if humanity was created by an alien and we went to try and meet our makers? Except it kind of basically more or less answers most of that question within the first 5 minutes, and then it spends, I suppose in reality, more like an hour.
Yeah.
But it just spends an hour sort of talking around that without really adding anything new to what it did in the first place. The plot as it is, I suppose I should mention some of that at least. Noomi Rapace is a Dr. Elizabeth Shaw, who, along with her partner, find a bunch of cave paintings, which they somehow manage to work out as a star map to the planet of the engineers. They treat it as an invitation to try and track down this planet of where they believe humanity was seeded by these engineers. Turns out they're right, who'd have thought it. They managed to convince the Wayland Corporation to put up the money to send an expedition party out there. They fly off to this planet and they find a structure that turns out to be essentially a chemical warfare plant, I suppose, a biological warfare plant. The problem is, well, they've gone off to try and meet their maker, as it were, and there's a sort of recurring and incredibly ham-fisted subplot of the ship's board robot David, played by Michael Fassbender, which presumably means he's a robot with a massive schlong.
luscious is the word you're looking for, Scott.
So again, he's talking about, he's obviously met his makers. His makers made him and are in the same ship as him, and some sort of interplay trying to go in between that, except it's not particularly interesting or very well handled or intelligent or clever.
No.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to try and like have so much of the film based around this. And this goes on for about an hour, and then after that hour, it turns into what you'd probably recognise in an Aliens film, or at least an Alien film, a slightly sci-fi tinged body horror. But problem is, it's not built any tension, and it's not built any nice, believable or interesting characters by that point. Just none of it really seems to work particularly well. There's no characters in here that I kind of cared about at all. And it's not like there's a bad cast or anything. Under like the entire prosthesis supply of the year, but Guy Pearce is, I like Noomi Pace, I like Michael Fassbender, I like Charlize Theron. There's a whole bunch of people here I thought would have done far better than what they managed to do here, but there's just nothing interesting happens, and then it starts doling out alien monstrosities at you to try and scare you a little bit. But by that point, I just couldn't care.
I don't actually get where Ridley Scott gets off at saying, well, no, it's not a prequel at all. It should be considered at best sort of a loose prequel, because it is actually entirely obviously set up to be a prequel.
Yeah, there's no question about that. It definitely is. I mean, aside from the fact, I can only think he's trying to come up with that because, thematically, it's got almost nothing in common with Aliens.
Yeah.
Or Alien, but or Aliens.
For me, that's his biggest problem, is that thematically, it's got enough to chew on, and there's really no need for it to have been canonical to the Alien franchise, no matter how loosely he himself would perceive it. I would say it's blatantly part of the canon. The central theme could have made for an interesting enough film. I can only imagine that the only way a 74 or 75, whatever age Sir Ridley is now, a director like him could get the money for a project like that would be for the studio to say, well, look, you're going to have to make it part of the Alien franchise, because that's the only way we're going to tempt the punters in. And it's a real shame, because like you say, it's an interesting enough theme. It's not a theme that's necessarily been discussed in a sort of mainstream way before. The whole idea of meeting your maker, Ridley Scott himself has done before in Blade Runner. But if you want to apply it in the context of humanity, obviously there's been a great deal of discussion about that stuff of late in scientific circles and whatnot. Although unfortunately, in the puff pieces I've seen with Sir Ridley, he seems to be basing a lot of his knowledge on Eric Van Daniken, which were dismissed as being particularly hammy about 30 years ago, although no one seems to have told Sir Ridley. I would have liked to have seen those ideas explored in a sort of mature way without anyone having to turn into a monster, their chest burst open and have stuff come out.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to get at with this whole retrofitting idea. It just feels like it's an idea that doesn't belong in the franchise, and you've tried to push it in there. And if you took this film, cut out the last 45 minutes of what you'd roughly recognise as being part of the Aliens universe, and moved the very first scene to the end, you might have wound up with something that was actually quite interesting.
Yeah.
But what you've got now at the minute is something that admittedly looks spectacular and looks like it does fit in tremendously well with the kind of Aliens universe, and aesthetically I thought it was a very pleasing film.
Oh, definitely.
And for all I'm complaining about these characters, they're very well acted and all that kind of stuff. It's by no means you can see the money that's been spent on it.
It's visually incredibly rich.
Yeah, but dramatically there's nothing there. There's nothing you get your teeth into. But if you kind of rejigger it a bit, I can see where you're coming from, and it would actually have been like a at least mildly interesting exploration of this kind of thing. Whereas at the minute it's just a mess.
I kind of enjoyed it despite myself, but they've made all sorts of bizarre choices. I'd like to see the original script. I can't help but feel like there are whole sections which must have been excised to keep the running time down. I'm not entirely happy with the motivations of Michael Fassbender's android character, David. He seems to
very puzzling, isn't it?
He seems to spend a lot of time sabotaging things and killing people just for the sake of being a dick. It's never really fully explained as to what his motivations were. We assume he's there in the first place to carry out within a certain period of time, it becomes clear that he's there to carry out an agenda which humans might find disagreeable. It might be difficult to find someone to carry out those actions who wasn't a robot. But also, several things annoyed me about it. There was the necessity of Noomi Rapace's character having to be English and hamstring her with this cut glass English accent, which she simply cannot pull off and which jarred horrendously. My really big bugbear, what year is this film set in?
About 100 years from now, give or take.
Why are the helmet cams so shit? Why do the helmet cams in this film, the feed from the helmet cams still looks like a sort of 8th generation VHS copy of the original Alien. There's all sorts of... The decision...
Her helmet cams are VGA. Yeah. Wow.
at the very sort of... It's probably not ruining it, because the first encounter any of the team have with alien life forms doesn't turn out too well for the couple of characters involved. But for about half an hour leading up to that encounter, there's been an almost sort of slapstick vibe as these two people who have been cut off from the rest of the group run around basically going, ooh, mummy, jumping at their own shadows, shitting themselves at the notion of what might be in this place. And then at the first instance of this, what I thought was a quite menacing-looking creature approaching them, the instinct of the character in question is to walk over it and go, ooh, come here, little alien, ooh, who's a pretty alien? And then you can imagine what happens. Absolutely bizarre. I can't help but feel that these elements have been put in there to service the studio's expectations of the return, because for them to spend the kind of money they've spent on this, it needs a mainstream hook. We couldn't realistically have expected them to spend that kind of money on an intelligent, you know, panspermia.
Or esoteric metaphysics.
Yeah, a sort of panspermia thought piece. And look at something like, ever since Contact, ever since they pumped that kind of money into Contact, which is a brilliant, brilliant film, but it just didn't do anything at the box office, you can understand why... You can understand why a studio would be reluctant to give that kind of money to a production which concerns itself with asking a lot of massively philosophical questions but doesn't actually deliver much spectacle. And I would much rather that he had just said, okay, let's just make an out-and-out prequel to the Alien films rather than have this sort of like strange hybrid thing which he's desperate to convince everyone isn't canonical, but which quite clearly is, and is there. Yeah. And it hamstrings the whole sort of notion that I assume he was trying to explore when he conceived of the idea, and it's a real shame. I can't say that I didn't enjoy it. I mean, I didn't enjoy it greatly, but I did come out thinking, yeah, it was all right, I'm glad I saw it. But I think a lot of that was down to the presentation, and like we were saying before, like visually it's an incredibly rich film, and it would be a complete shame to go and, you know, waste your eyes seeing it in 3D, because the 2D print I saw, correctly projected, kudos to the View Cinema at Cheshire Oaks, I might add, for the best presentation I've seen in a cinema. That print is absolutely unbelievable. If indeed it was a print, I'm assuming it's probably shot on digital. But
I did go and watch it in 3D, and it added nothing whatsoever. Yeah. I don't know if it was shot in 3D or whatever, but certainly there's no point wasting your extra £2, whatever it is, for the 3D version of it. There's nothing added to it. I figured, Ridley Scott, I respect him as director, surely he's put something into it, and, well, no. Yeah. A horrible feeling that's a studio thumbprint and anything else, but no, don't bother with the 3D version if you can get away with seeing something that isn't.
Exactly. But like you say, that opening scene, I can't help but feel the intention of that scene is that you're supposed to get to a point in the film where all of a sudden you're supposed to have a moment of epiphany and say, oh my God, I've just realised that at the beginning of the film, that was Earth.
Because it seems like the most obvious thing in the world.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And like you say, it kind of answers its own question. That sort of opening 5 minutes would have been interesting in and of itself as a short film. It doesn't really service the film any other than, as you say, to sort of completely undermine the rest of the plot.
And it doesn't really seem to bridge anything either. For all is quite clearly this is set in the Aliens universe, it's an Aliens prequel, but the engineers are just dreadful. They're not even remotely interesting characters. Yeah. The few questions that are sort of remotely searching that it does ask are just kind of left hanging. Then they go off and do a at best adequate ape of the first Alien film.
Mm.
And it's just very unsatisfying.
Yeah, if you want to set up 2 hours of exposition to, you know, what happens when you meet your makers, and the answer is they get a bit angry for some reason and try and crush your skull, then, yeah, I can't help but feel that could have been taken care of in a lot less time and with a lot less effort. but certainly a little bit more thought might have been appreciated. Like you say, like I would still say it's worth going to see. I mean, there are redeeming elements there. It's just that if you're expecting this to be the next best thing to Aliens, then don't hold your breath. But I spent a lot of my time after we'd been to see it thinking, is this an intelligent sci-fi piece masquerading as a big-budget piece of fluff, or is it a big-budget piece of fluff masquerading as an intelligent piece of sci-fi? And in the end, I don't think it's actually either. It's a strange beast. And it feels oddly disjointed, and it sets up all kinds of expectations, none of which are delivered upon.
I think coming out of this, I was so disappointed. I would suggest that anyone that likes alien films actually don't go and see this. I really didn't. It feels like a cut and shut. It feels like two different films soldered together in the middle with a very obvious join. The second half of the question deals with an entirely different set of questions the first half of the film does, and it doesn't feel in any way satisfying. I was deeply disappointed by it. I mean, I actually like Alien 3 more than I like this film.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I mean, okay, let's revisit that in a year, maybe after a while it's sort of sunk in, and then, well, actually, no, it does make a lot of sense, but I really can't see that happening. I think that the crucially under... I don't know why it's so reviled, Alien 3. I like Alien 3 quite a bit.
Alien 3 is quite decent. It's not Alien Resurrection.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's reviled because David Fincher made such a noise about the fact that he basically wished he could have disowned it in the first place. But even as that existed in the original print, with the studio interference, I still thought it was a pretty interesting film.
If nothing else, it's a film where the guy at the Tetley Tea adverts runs about saying, once again, this is rumour control. What more do you want from a film? I mean, I try very desperately not to build my hopes up for any film these days because I'm deeply cynical. There's so many films that I've thought, oh, this is going to be fantastic going into, that now I just try and avoid any knowledge whatsoever. Perhaps that serves people better. I mean, my girlfriend didn't actually know this had any correlation to the Aliens universe at all going into it.
Mm.
And I thought perhaps that would have served her a bit better to kind of judge it on its own merits, but she thought it was kind of crap as well. To me, it seems, like you say, I would love to see the original script, because this seems like it is a script that had no relation to the Aliens universe that has been hastily retrofitted into it. Mm. And you can kind of see where the joins are. It's almost well acted and well shot and well handled and sort of visually stunning enough to kind of be worth seeing as a spectacle more than anything else. But I can't recommend it as anything more than that.
I just remembered as well what the other thing was that really, really annoyed me. Is it just me, or at a certain point in the film, and to try and not ruin it for it, I assume most people have seen it already anyway, but not to try and ruin it, there is a point in the film at which three characters, or two characters, are convinced by one other character to take part in what should have been an incredibly valiant act of self-sacrifice. At which point, I was absolutely baffled by the ease and joviality with which these other characters were convinced to take part in such an act.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say any more than that, but that was bizarre.
I see what you're getting at, especially when it comes from... It's actually perhaps the three characters that are the most underserved.
Yes.
I mean, there's actually one of those characters that I could not tell you what his function was.
No, yeah, I know exactly the one of which you speak.
It's puzzling when you have... It specifically said at the start, like, there's only 14 people supposedly on the ship,
yeah,
which you would think... You would at least be able to remember the names or jobs of most of them.
Mm.
There seems to be one person that's wandering about. The ginger-haired geologist from an earlier scene is wandering around. And why are these people there? What's the point of most of them? I mean, there's no real reason for them to be there. They could have been replaced by a bag, for the most part.
And
it's like, I'm a geologist. What do you mean you're a geologist? Well, I have these probes that I throw up in the air and then they vanish and map the area for the rest of the film, and then I have no influence whatsoever over them. It's like, well, couldn't you have just given them those probes and then stayed at home?
a piece of balsa wood would have sufficed in place of the woman playing the ship's doctor. That was, oh my goodness, unbelievably chronic. Unbelievably chronic. It's so strange. So strange that short thrift has been paid to it. I would be intrigued to see, because Ridley Scott has hinted, well, not even hinted strongly, he's basically said there is stuff which he would like to put back in. I would assume that means we're going to, you know, part of his deal with the studio is that he's going to be allowed a director's cut at some point, and for once that will be a genuine director's cut.
Yeah.
not a studio director's cut. At that point, I will revisit the film. I won't be in a hurry to revisit it before then.
No.
So it's a real shame. Like you say, I think fans of the franchise are going to see it anyway, but it's one of those things that you wish, you wish with all your heart you could convince someone in that position not to go and see this yet.
Mm-hmm.
Very odd. Very odd indeed. I feel like it's some sort of payback, because I had such expectations of Tinker Tailor last year and it delivered in spades that I actually felt guilty about it. And I guess for this year, this was the flip side of that. Well, I guess that's just about us. No promises as to when we'll be back in touch with you guys, but hopefully it should be sooner than the gap you've just experienced. If there's anyone still out there listening to us, remember, it's podcast@theoneliner.com if you want to get in touch. You can follow us on Twitter, Scott at
The One Liner.
Until next we speak, I bid you adieu. I have been Craig. Scott was Scott.
Bye.
Andrew was, as always, the inimitable Mr. Drew.
Very well.
Cheerio. I'm going to go and get a massive Scotch egg.